87, you know, page 87, going through page 94 of the book. We'll be looking at the book, the entire book of Esther this morning. Chapters 1 through 10. On Wednesday, we went through Zechariah, where we're at, the story. We went through chapters 1 through 4 of Ezra, and we looked at Haggai and Zechariah, encouraging the people in chapter 5, verse 1 of Ezra to begin working on the temple again. Right? So we kind of finished that up on Wednesday with Zechariah, the order of decree of the Darius to stop working at the end of chapter 4 of Ezra, and now we look at Haggai and Zechariah, encouraging them to continue this work. Esther kind of falls within the same, within this time period, okay? The people returning back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city, rebuild the temple. And we look at the book of Esther, and we're kind of going back to the other side, Mesopotamia area, and looking at what's going on there in the story of Esther. In Ezra chapter 4, verse 6, have that on my PowerPoint, I forgot. Ezra chapter 4, verse 6 and 7, we see Ahasuerus, or Artaxerxes, is the king at this point, right? And we talked about how that was Cambyses, the son of Nabonidus, right? So this is where we're falling in the historical timeline here. The reign of Cambyses, Artaxerxes, Ahasuerus, again, all the same person ruling here. Ezra chapter 4, verse 6 and 7. So looking at the book of Esther, chapter 1, King Ahasuerus throws a large 7-day feast for several of his officials and servants. He has this big spread. In verse 3, is in the third year of his reign. And he said, it says, for many days, 180 days in all, he was throwing this feast. But then in the last 7 days of this feast, they're getting drunk, they're having this great time. And then on the 7th day, he brings out, calls for Queen Vashti to be shown before, in front of all these officials, to be shown off, showing off her beauty. Bob mentions in the book how some suggest that maybe he was presenting her in very immodest, perhaps even naked fashion before these men. Not a lot of evidence for that. But again, in some way or another, King Ahasuerus is trying to present and show off all of his possessions to these officials, right? So on the 7th day of this feast, he calls for Queen Vashti to be brought in front of all the officials. But Queen Vashti refuses. In verse 12, it says she refused to come out the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. So Queen Vashti refuses to follow with his command, and obviously the king gets furious at this. So he consults his wise men as to what to do with the queen, because she refused to come out to him. So the wise men's response is to make a decree that Queen Vashti be deposed from her position, for not obeying the king, and that he get a new queen, right? They said that this would teach all women in the kingdom to honor their husbands, obey their husbands, because Queen Vashti refusing to obey the king's command was setting this bad example, right, in their minds, for all the people to not honor their husbands, not obey their husbands. So, again, they suggest that he make this decree that Queen Vashti be deposed from her position as queen, and that he find a new queen. So that brings us up to the end of chapter 1. In chapter 2, it says after the king's anger subsides, his servant suggests that they bring these young, beautiful virgins before him, prepare these young women to be brought before the king and presented before him. And then we see in verses 5 and 6, Mordecai introduced, and we're going to see Mordecai throughout the rest of the story. It says in verse 5, in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So, Mordecai comes from the descendants of the second group of captives of Jeconiah, or Jehoiachin, as we read about in 2 Kings, I believe it's 2 Kings 24. So Mordecai is introduced here in verses 5 and 6. Descendant of these Jews and of Benjamin. You remember we talked about in Ezra chapter 1, the tribe of Benjamin was one of the first groups, right, to go back to Jerusalem. So Mordecai falls within that family. So Mordecai had taken, it explains in the following verses, how Mordecai had taken Esther kind of under his wing. She was his cousin, technically, his uncle's daughter. And Mordecai had kind of taken Esther under his wing and raised her. And she was one of these beautiful virgins that was chosen to be presented, prepared for presentation to the king. So we read in the middle of chapter 2 how Esther spends, or they spend a whole year preparing Esther and these other virgins to be presented to the king. It goes on to explain how Esther found particular favor in the eyes of King Ahasuerus at this time. And in response to that, she is made queen over the land. Then we kind of take a turn a little bit in verse 19 through 23. Kind of takes a little bit of a break in the story to explain a particular instance in which Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate, verse 19, hears about these two men who had planned to kill the king. So Mordecai reports these men to the king and ends up saving the king's life. He tells Queen Esther about it, and Esther informs the king. And again, these men are taken care of and hanged at the gallows, it says in verse 23. But this is, again, it seems like a break in the story at this point, but this is going to be turn out to be a very important part of the story, particularly in chapter 6. Okay? But we kind of take a little bit of a break in verses 19 through 23 of the narrative to explain this particular part of the story, Mordecai saving the king's life by reporting these two men who plotted to kill him. So in chapter 3, we see another man introduced, Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, says in verse 1. So Haman is promoted by the king. So Haman is going in and out of the king's gate, and as Haman goes in and out of the king's gate on a daily basis, people are bowing to him, paying homage to him, showing him respect. But Mordecai refuses to do so. And obviously, Haman doesn't like that. He refuses to pay homage to Haman. And Haman is displeased with Mordecai's refusal to pay him respect. So he decides to handle this problem himself. In verse 6, it says he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai, the Jews. So Haman's solution to this problem of Mordecai not paying him respects was kill all the Jews, right? So he makes this decree in verses 8 through 9. It says, there is a certain, he's talking to King Ahasuerus, because there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom, referring to the Jews. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work, bring it into the king's treasuries. So Haman, with his ultimate disdain for Mordecai, decides to make this decree that anybody who wants to on a certain day, as we're going to read here in a minute, can go out and just kill the Jews. Go at it. And he offers in 10,000 talents of silver, a large sum of money, to whoever goes out and carries this work. So in verse 15, what we said there, on the 13th of the 12th month, month Adar. All people, again, are allowed to go and attack and kill the Jews. That was the time allotted for this to be done. And so the decree is made in verse 15. And it says how the king and Haman sit down to drink. They're just going about their daily business, enjoying each other's company, and you know, getting drunk. But the city of Shushan, this capital city, was perplexed. It was confused. They were confused, not really understanding what was going on. Why has this decree been made? So the rest of the people are confused as to why this is being done. But nonetheless, Haman allows this, the king allows this decree to be made on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, these Jews being allowed to be killed. So in chapter 4, the Jews mourn this over this decree. And Mordecai, seeing opportunity, goes to Queen Esther and begs that Esther have this reversed somehow, to take this issue before the king. And Esther, initially, she's concerned about her life, right? She's concerned because she doesn't want to come before the king, because if they were to come before the king without being summoned by him, there was a chance that they could be killed. Without being invited into the king's presence, they could be killed for that. So Esther's initially concerned about this, right? But listen to Mordecai's response in verse 13. It says, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." So again, Mordecai's response essentially is, maybe you'll avert from being killed, from coming into the presence of the king, unsummoned. But eventually, it's going to come back on you. You are going to be killed. You're going to bear the same fate as the rest of the Jews. So he encourages her with this, not only with that, but also the encouragement of, maybe this is why you're in this position. Maybe this is why you are queen right now, to deliver the Jews from this fate. So Esther agrees, after being encouraged by Mordecai, to take this matter before the king. No longer concerned for her own life, but really for the life of the king. You see that in verse 16. She says, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Again, you kind of see Esther's focus transition from herself to her people, and she's focused more now on what she needs to do. So in chapter 5, Esther plans to, this is how she's going to go about asking the king, right? This is how she's going to go about presenting this issue before King Ahasuerus. So she plans to have this banquet for the king and for Haman. So she invites both the king and Haman to the banquet. And of course, Haman is thrilled at this point, right? He's been promoted in chapter 3. Now in chapter 5, he's been invited by the queen herself to this very special banquet. So Haman is just thrilled with his importance, or seeming importance at this time. So he returns home, and you see in verses, verse 12, and really verses 10 through 13, Haman just bragging about his accomplishments to his family. He's bragging to his wife, bragging to his kids about the things that he's accomplished, and the ways that he's been acknowledged, glorified, and now Queen Esther has invited him to this banquet. But even still, he's overcome with this hatred for Mordecai. In spite of all of these good things that he's bragging about to his family, he's still just overcome with this hatred that he has for Mordecai. So So his family suggests that he build a gallows to hang Mordecai on before going to Esther's banquet. It says in verse 14, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. So, again, their suggestion is, just take care of this before you go to the banquet. You don't have to worry about Mordecai when you're at this banquet. Go ahead and just suggest that Mordecai be hanged. You know, you'll have Mordecai out of the way. You'll be able to go to this banquet and enjoy your time with the king and the queen. So, this pleases Mordecai. So he has this gallows made in verse 14, chapter 5. Chapter 6, we see a really interesting, fortunate, but unfortunate turn of events for Haman in verses 1 through 3. Let's read this together, because I think chapter 6 is one of my favorite chapters of the book of Esther. Let's read this, verses 1 through chapter 6. That night, the king could not sleep, so one was commanded to bring the book of the record to the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So Ahasuerus can't sleep, so he demands that the chronicles of what's been happening in his reign be read to him at night. And it just so happens that they read of this portion of the book, the Chronicles, where Mordecai saved the king's life. The night before Mordecai is supposed to be hanged on the gallows by Haman. And they read this portion of where Mordecai saves the king's life. And the king says, what do we do for Mordecai for this? For saving my life? Do we do anything for him? And the servants say, no, nothing's been done. So he calls Haman in. And he says to Haman, what should be done for someone who the king desires to honor? We've seen at this point Haman's view of himself, right? And, you know, he's been shown favor by the king by being promoted. He's been shown favor by the queen by being invited to this banquet. So Haman thinks, surely the one that he's wanting to honor is me. So let's read Haman's response. The king asks, what should be done for someone who I delight to honor? It says in verse 7, Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor, then parade him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Pretty excellent display, right? Taking one of the king's robes, the king's horses, with the crest of the king on the horse, taking this man and having one of his royal princes parade him through the streets and say, this is a man that the king wants to honor. And then the king responds and says, do so for Mordecai the Jew who sits within the king's gate. He says, hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai. All of this Haman expected for himself. And now the very man that he hates, he is the one having to parade through the streets and glorify for the king. One of my favorite, I love this, I get so excited thinking about the story because, again, it's just a perfect display of justice in our minds, right? But again, Haman having to do this for Mordecai, takes Mordecai, places this robe on him, arrays him, puts him on the horseback, and it says in verse 11, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king delights to honor. You can just see Haman carrying him through the streets on this horse, saying these things about him. So Haman, distraught over his shame, he goes home and he starts pouting, telling his family about what happened. So verse 13, listen to the response of the family. When Haman tells them about what happened, when Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wife men and his wife, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall." This is a significant statement in the book of Esther. Because up until this point, the Lord's name has not been mentioned. No mention of God, and we'll see that throughout the rest of the book. Nowhere in the book of Esther is God's name even mentioned. Okay? But up until this point, this is really the first reference that we see, other than what Mordecai said to Esther, to any providence, right? Or any protection from the Lord is really what I think she's referencing here in chapter 6, verse 13. That these Jewish people, God's people, were known in captivity as a special people, right? At the very least, she understood that. And I had this question up here. What makes them special? What makes them special is the fact the Lord had protected them up until this point. And they were known for this. They were known for this by the people. And I guess she didn't know that in chapter 5, verse 14, when she suggested building this gallows. I'm not sure. But when it comes to her attention that Mordecai is Jewish, it's like it changes everything. Oh, well, he's Jewish? Well, there's no way you're going to prevail against him. But again, just emphasizes the reputation that these Jewish people had amongst these foreign people, their captors. The reputation that the Jewish people have for the Lord's protection. Alright. In chapter 7, Haman arrives at the banquet. Haman and the king, and the king asks Esther of her request. Up until this point, Esther has not requested that the king do something about the decree that has been made. She planned this banquet to ask him there, in front of Haman, right? So, the king says, "What is it that you want?" And so Esther just kind of pours out her heart concerning this matter. She says, "My people are planned to be killed, and Haman is the man that's responsible for this." And the king, extremely frustrated and infuriated by this, leaves the presence, says he goes out into the garden, and the queen and Haman are left alone. Haman, you can just imagine the look on his face here, expecting to be, you know, have some relief, especially after what had just happened in chapter 6, being humiliated, have some relief by being in the presence of the queen and king. And here, he's even more horrified by the fact that the queen is of Jewish descent, and now he is being reported as being responsible for the one responsible for decreeing to kill her people. The horror on his face, you can just imagine. So he begs Queen Esther to save his life. And you get this picture in the text that talks about how he's laying over her couch. I just imagine him just crawling towards her, saying, "Please just save me, please," just begging her. And the king comes back in right at that moment, right when he's just laying over the couch, pleading for his life, and it looks like he's making some kind of advances towards her. He says, "Are you going to do this right here in front of me, in my presence?" And so the king immediately orders Haman to be hanged on the gallows that he had made for Mordecai. The eunuch is the one that tells him about it in verse 9. Harbona tells the king about this gallows that Haman had made for Mordecai, and the king ends up decreeing that Haman be hanged on it himself. Verse 8 mentions how they covered his face. As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Bob mentions this in the book. It's just kind of this indication that the king's wrath was against Haman. Kind of what the text is getting at and saying it that way. Alright, so Haman is hanged, end of chapter 7. The gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And then in chapter 8, Mordecai is given all the glory of Haman. It says in verse 2, the king took off his signet ring. Chapter 3 and verse 10, he had given his signet ring to Haman to write this decree, you remember. But now he's giving the signet ring to Mordecai and ultimately ends up giving Haman's house to Esther, and Esther gives that to Mordecai. So again, we kind of see Mordecai inheriting all of the glory that Haman was reveling in, was glorifying himself. So Esther, in chapter 8, pleads with the king once again, because still, this decree was standing, right? And if you remember, the law could not be changed. The laws of the Medes and the Persians could not be changed. So she still pleads with him again, asking that there be some kind of revoking of the letters that Haman had written. So the king ends up giving Esther and Mordecai permission to write a decree with his signet ring to somehow make this better, right? Because he couldn't undo everything that he had written, or that Haman had written concerning killing the Jews. So he gives them the signet ring and gives them an opportunity to write their own decree. So we see that decree in verses 9 through 12. We won't read all of that. But the idea is, okay, yes, people have this opportunity on this 13th day of the 12th month of Adar to go kill the Jews, but now the Jews have an opportunity to defend themselves. That's basically what their decree is in verses 9 through 12. So in chapter 3, verses 12 through 14, just kind of counteracting that decree that had been made there, we see that in verses 9 through 12 in chapter 8. So in verses 16 through 17, just notice this here. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor, and in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, feast and holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. And again, we're still seeing God allowing his people to prosper in captivity. Some people have already returned back to Jerusalem, as we've read, and we know at this point in the story. The walls of Jerusalem and the temple are being rebuilt during this time. But God has still not forgotten the people that are in captivity, allowing them to prosper. It says the fear of the Jews had come upon of these people. So in chapter 9, we see that 13th day, the 12th month of Adar, come up. And the people come out against the Jews to kill them. But in verses 1 through 2, we see how the Jews just totally slaughter those who come up against them. It says in verse 2, the Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the province of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. So again, God allowing them to prosper, allowing them to really just have this utter slaughter of the people that were coming out against them to kill them. And then verse 10, chapter 9, if you notice, Haman's sons come out to fight against the Jews. And it says in verse 10, they killed them, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. In chapter 3 and verse 13, within the first decree that Haman had made in regard to killing these Jews, part of the permission in this decree was that they plunder their possessions at the end of verse 13. And then in chapter 8 and verse 11, part of the decree that Esther and Mordecai made for the Jews once they defended themselves was to plunder the possessions of those who sought to kill them. So I find it interesting here God thought it important to mention that they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And that wasn't what they were seeking. They weren't sinking just to plunder the possessions, even though they had permission to do that. So it's an interesting contrast to the decree that had been made in chapter 3 and verse 13, and also an interesting note that they had had permission to do so according to the decree, but did not do it. Chapter 9 and verse 13, it looks like they just hang the dead bodies of Haman's sons on a gallows. They've already killed them in chapter 10, or excuse me, verse 10. But it said, they asked that, verse 13, let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So it looks like they're just hanging these Haman's sons' dead bodies on the gallows. Again, what an act of disgrace for Haman and his family. But really an act of justice we see here being done. Verses 15 through 16, the onslaught continues. But again, at the end of verse 15 and at the end of verse 16, it says they did not lay a hand on the plunder of both verses. So again, just another contrast comparison with chapter 3 and verse 13 and chapter 8 and verse 11. Mr. Richter said it. This is a common, I don't know who all heard that, but this is a common act, just really disgrace, whenever they defeated an enemy, to sometimes impale the body or just hang up the dead body for display. All right, in 21 through 22, we see the Feast of Purim initiated this feast for this opportunity the Jews have had to defend themselves and for the victory that they had over these people who had come to attack them. We see that celebrated in verses 21 through 22. And then 26, it's referred to as the Days of Purim. After the name Pur, or Pur, however you say that in Hebrew, which was in chapter 3 and verse 7, the casting of the lots, right? When Haman had cast lots on what day that they were going to kill the Jews, it says in chapter 3 and verse 7, they cast Pur, or that is, the lot. So they named this feast Purim, or Purim, after that casting of lots. So just an interesting note. And actually, this feast is still kept today in the month of March. All right. Talk real quickly about some lessons, practical lessons for us. And I'm sure there are more, but these are just one or two that I pulled out. Of course, if you have more, we can talk about that. But in chapter 4, in verses 13 through 14, when Mordecai responds back to Esther, he says, don't think that you're going to escape. You know, relief will come for the Jews, whether it's by your hand or someone else. He says, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. One thing I thought that was in a time when God might have seen least present, you know, being in captivity, even though some people had returned from captivity at this time. In a time being in captivity when God might have seen least present, still Mordecai trusted in his promise, God's promise of deliverance. I think that's a pretty important point to note. Mordecai was still putting his trust in God at this time. Kind of along with that, God's name, as I said, is not mentioned at all in the book. But in the same vein, in a time when God seemed least present, God was still working for his people. And you see that throughout the entire book. To not see God's hand in the book of Esther, again, is to really ignore the very observation that the wife of Haman had made. God's protection of his people. It was obvious. It was obvious to them, and it should be obvious to us
reading the book of Esther.
It's a great lesson for us. Excuse me. go ahead. Sure. Right. So, Mr. Bryant was saying he likes the play or Mordecai's take on Esther's free will, but also God's providence, right? His ability to bring about his purposes with or without Esther. And that's exactly what Mr. Holt's somewhat of a definition there of God's providence is God's ability to rule in the affairs of men without overruling man's free will. That's a great, great thought. Also very important for us, too, on a practical level, just to understand that whether or not we're going to serve God willingly, God's purposes are going to be accomplished. So we can either willingly be a part in that or step out of the way, get wiped out of the way, really, ultimately, for God's will to be done. Really important lesson for us, so just in submission to God's will. All right, and then the last thought that I had here, which I guess this goes along with everything we've discussed up to this point, but God's providence is still working in our lives, even when it seems as if he is not present. All three of the things I have up there, almost the same thing. But again, understanding that even when God may not feel or seem present in our life, we have to understand that if we are willingly submitting to him, that he will accomplish his purposes as we've already identified. And he will do that with us if we willingly submit as Esther does in that book. Yeah, Lorenzo's making the point to contrast Daniel and Esther. You see miraculous ways in which Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are delivered from the fiery furnace. Daniel is miraculously delivered from the lions. But then the contrast is in Esther, you don't see those miraculous, so much see those miraculous things taking place, but God's purpose is still being accomplished. And, I think that's also a good important point for us. We don't have to always see some miraculous display from God to trust that, you know, that we can trust in him, right? Or that he's working his purposes in our lives. Right? That we can put our confidence in him anyway. Yeah, that's an excellent point. All right. I was going to expound on that, but we're running out of time. Thank you for your comments and attention. Appreciate that.